about embedded system network protocols, as we've done everything that you support. Little history. We originally, not originally, but excuse me, everything was VME, VxWorks, using MOOC. And there came a time when we couldn't use, for expense reasons, VME-based solutions or VxWorks. And so we were moving to x86 platforms, and originally we weren't even using Linux. We were using ECOS, which is another RTOS. And so we needed to have some, since ACNET didn't run in such an environment, we had to come up with a solution to be able to get our data in and out of our embedded system in an operational setting. And so we came up with, we've already talked last week a bit about a lot of this, so some of this is an overlap, but we came up with a sort of a homebrew, simple UDP-based protocol. And so if we come on here. And essentially, originally looked like this, where these would be our embedded systems here, and they ran a protocol that we developed called PEP, which is Packet Exchange Protocol. And that, those could be Linux-based or bare metal, or they could be, you know, some other RTOS. And then we had a in a sort of a centrally located situation, we had a standard VME VX Workspace system running MOOC, and we had a PEP client that ran under VxWorks that sort of bridged to MOOC, and then that would talk to our consoles, and then on. Basically used LabVIEW on PCs that also had a PEP client to talk to our embedded systems for engineering applications. All right. And this worked great. And the problem with it was, of course, it's kind of complicated. And the other thing is that I had to support the whole thing. The controls department wasn't involved in this at all. And so it worked, but as soon as the controls department came out with their Axis FE, we knew that we wanted to replace and go to a sort of simpler architecture. This is what we are using right now, where you still have your lab for your PC or for engineering applications, and it talks to PEP or to the PEP server in your embedded system, which is now run Linux exclusively. But now the controls department has their Axis FE, which is ACNET, to run around in Linux, and we wrote essentially it's a C driver that sort of translates between the Erlang code, and it actually talks, it's a PEP client that's built in there. So, but that runs not over a network, it runs over the loopback, which is basically a memory network. And so then this talks that into the consoles. This, of course, doesn't work for everybody. It's complex in a different way. It's complex, and you have to understand how all this works and make it work. It's architecturally simpler. So you can imagine, okay, this is sort of the what's happening right now. This is new and actually isn't finished yet, is that Dennis Nicholas is working on a Erlang-based PEP driver, which would, you'd get it with Axis out of the box, and then that talks to a PEP server out of the box. And then it's also, the benefits of it being it's hopefully higher performance, but that it also would allow down the stream of you having, if you had an embedded system that you didn't want to have the complication of having it be an active front end, you could go back to almost to the original architecture it had, where you have your embedded systems that are just running PEP, which is very simple, and you can use your engineering apps, and then you could be a separate node that was even front-ending your PEP-based embedded systems. And this one could actually front-end a whole bunch of them, right? You could have this thing front-ending 10 or 20 or whatever of your embedded systems, and it would talk, this is a PEP client talking PEP protocol to your embedded system. This is possible as soon as Dennis finishes this. I don't know how close he is to doing that. But, it's a work in progress. Any questions on any of this?
I'm gonna ask a question.
Yeah.
What's the advantage of Irvine here? What do we get?
Well, that's kind of a moot point in the sense that they decided.
I understand. Yeah, but is it?
The reason they chose it? I mean, they can speak for themselves, but let Dennis answer it, I guess.
I mean, it's not, the Erlang doesn't matter so much, but what matters more is that we moved it into just Linux and...
Yeah, if it's transparent to me, yeah.
Right. So what really matters is that we moved it for, especially for network-connected thing, we moved it off of single-purpose BME cards that are more expensive, and we can use any commodity computer now. I mean, that's really the...
Erlang came out of the telecom industry, and it's very powerful for, you know, doing a lot of parallel processing, and you know, it's all about network computing and stuff, and so that's the reasons they chose it way back, you know, however many years ago it was now, but...
So your plan is to build some kind of Erlang library that goes into a front end? Is that what...
Well, so we have a library of different device drivers in Erlang, you know, for mostly for network connected things. And so we have them for like Modbus PLCs, we have them for, you know, TCP connected random things and a lot of other things.
So we custom things. We shouldn't know anything, like when it should be up. I guess my question is the talking to it. You know, the driver.
Right, so
just
the
function call,
the hardware doesn't, like the PEP server end of this doesn't care who's receiving it, whether it's Erlang or...
Yeah, the communication through here can either be over the network or it can be local. It's transparent, which it is. Yeah. And so it allows you, if you need a high performance, you do it this way. If you just need slow stuff that, you know, parameter page type stuff, then you can do it like this. And you wouldn't need to have the added complication of having access in your front end.
Okay. So the access system or Erlang driver would be part by you guys.
Right.
How do you extend the PEP protocol? Like, does it have a...
Okay, well, that's my next slide.
Okay.
Okay.
So now I'm going to switch gears to from a sort of an architectural... understanding of how this all fits together to, if you were going to implement a PEP server, what would it look like? And just some pseudocode type thing. So you have your application code and you want to add a PEP, have it be a PEP server so you can talk to it. It's just a call. Let me back up a second. There's certain things that we determined that you're going to want in every embedded system, or at least we did. And so those are built into the PEP server itself. And those are the things like doing plotting, for doing trip, having trip buffers, like a transient recorder functionality, things like you want to be able to reboot your front end from remotely, things like that. And so those are in there, you just get them. And so there's a list of what we call them PEP packets that are predefined, and you just get them if you start up a PEP server. And for instance, the plotting, if you have a certain... One thing I always have in my embedded systems is a circular buffer. I'm acquiring data at a certain rate of kilohertz or something like that. So I stuff a circular buffer with all my analog inputs at that kilohertz and then whatever data that I want to be able to read. And that provides so that you can do plotting, fast time plotting, whatever. And that's all built in. So you still got to tell it, well, how many channels are there? How deep in time is it? Where's the base address of my structure? I can show you what it looks like. And then, so this starts it up, basically spawns off a pthread that's running, it's a server, it's listening on the network for somebody to talk to it and ask for data. And then if for your specific application, you might want to add your own stuff that you're going to want to be able to be accessed through the server. And so there's a way of registering a new custom PEP packet. And you call it like this, you tell it an ID, that's that PEP ID, how many dimensions we have, you can actually have one dimensional arrays or two dimensional arrays, and then the base address of it, and you can have a read callback or a set callback. The read callback runs beforehand, and the set callback is run after the data gets set. And so you can register like the addresses of your callbacks in there as well. And once that's done, then what this packet looks like that to actually talk to this is defined, and you can have a document that you know how to actually, it's a UDP packet, what the packet's got to look like and what the packet's going to look like that comes back to you. What else? Other issues, for simplicity's sake, all data that's transferred is four byte things. So it can be an unsigned 32-bit integer, a signed 32-bit integer, or a single precision float. Doesn't support any other data types. But that counts a lot. So the circular buffer, if you're going to implement a circular buffer, it's got to look like this. So basically, you have some structure that has however many channels that you want in it, and you define that up here. It's expecting certain channels to be in there, namely FTP timestamp. So if you want to do fast time plotting, you're going to have some way of having the FTP timestamp in there. And that's one of the channels. And so that a little bit of complication, but you have to be receiving the number two event, TCLOCK event, and resetting a counter. And that has to be stuffed in there, and then it knows how to properly timestamp fast time plot data. And then the actual circular buffer structure itself looks like this, where it's a certain depth, and then you keep track of it as you're moving through. I'm not going to belabor that anymore. But
what's that?
I'm not going to belabor that anymore because it's just details. Yeah. But I think that's all I had. Is there any questions about? I just wanted to give a flavor of the fact that this is simple. If you want to implement one of these, it's not hard. And it's pretty flexible because you can extend it. But then there's also quite a bit of stuff that's built into it that you get a lot of functionality right up front.
Do you handle SEM4s and stuff for where the mutex is now?
For what?
Let's say you have a process that you don't want interrupted and your PEP server wants to do something.
Well, this is all done with memory. So, I mean, you can have some high priority thing running in the background, and this thing is just running at a lower priority, and so it's not going to interrupt it.
Or you can use the callbacks to take and get a SEM4.
Yeah, that's it, actually, like the set callbacks, I often have some other high priority thing running waiting on a SEM4, and then the set callback will get it.
Okay.
So, because I let it know that, oh, we got new data, new RAMP got downloaded or something. You know.
Yeah, so this next step is running AXIS and PEP side by side, in a sense, where I can, on the same Ethernet, I can have PEP talk devices talking to that front end, and I can have that front end talking to the controls, or not.
I'm making sure I understand what you're talking about. This is sort of like how I do my front end.
That's right? How you do it now. What's the next slide? Again.
The next one. It's the same.
No, the one, okay. And then even the one after that.
And that goes back. Okay.
So your application really just handles talks via the PEP server.
Yes.
So it really doesn't even know anything about AXIS. It just says, hey, I've got these PEP packets coming in and out. And based on the semaphore to mutex, you can say, well, I can make a setting, or it gets read at the right priority level, and you don't really care anything about it.
The power that I found is that when I'm developing an embedded system, I don't even have ACNet in there. I don't, because everything is done with my engineering applications. And that way I'm debugging them in this model here. I'm debugging them by talking them through here through the PEP server. And it all just works. And then when you add this in, it uses the same communication mechanism. And so there's far less to debug. It just works.
So I'm on the verge of a command decision. I was talking to Philip. It's like, so low level RF is going to be going with an FPGA ARM process board that will use something like this. Kevin in EE Sports going to be using something like this. This with the PEP server to a front that we can make front ends for. Or maybe even a PEP client. Can this be a PEP client, this front end?
Yes.
Right.
I have
PEP. The PEP client is really the Erlang PEP driver there. It's really
there is a PEP client
okay.
in here.
So that's the client.
I have PEP servers and clients in VxWorks, LabVIEW, and Linux.
Okay. And so then
have we really resolved that though? I mean, if we're low, I don't know, Philip, if you talked to Brian about this as this server client issue. Who's the client, who's the server? In our models we've been using front end.
Well, you don't have
basically
you can,
the client.
It, you could be a full. You could be a full access front end. Okay. Right?
ACNET itself is a client server where the server is in the embedded system.
That's right.
If for your application you need to have additional things, well, then that would just be over here somewhere. Right? It's just you would have to add that. But ACNET itself works as
Before Craig goes any further, the current low level RF systems that are done in this way, not the current, you know, with an ARM processor or FPGA.
VXI things. Systems?
No, not VXI. It's standalone ones. Like
okay, this the current standalone ones. All right.
P2IT, that kind of thing. Those are done similar to this, but not with PEP protocol. It's a custom protocol that we built using the protocol compiler. That it's a little running in the FPGA ARM. There's a little C process, I guess you'd call it, that you know is speaking this protocol to our ACNET access front end. It's not the PEP protocol, it's a different one, and it's one that's built with our protocol compiler. But other than, you know, it's the same sort of model, but it's not PEP, it's not Greg's protocol. It's a separate protocol that, you know, transfers all the register contents back and forth.
Now, does it
do you see advantages in that one over these other methods? Or could we evolve to a single?
It could use a protocol like this. I mean, what it's more designed to do was to transfer the whole bunch of register readings all at once, periodically.
But
how we use it.
I don't know. If maybe it's something for you and Brian to go through, but the model we've been using, at least for our LabVIEW protocol, is that the front end was always the master sending out stuff, and we needed
right.
to display every packet of waveform so we can build
right.
build larger waveforms. Was still happening at the CMTS ACNET system you built. I know everything was going to LabVIEW, but
right.
I don't know if your system was just pulling and getting it when it wanted, right?
For most of the registers, yeah, that's
for the registers, it doesn't matter.
Right,
for
the waveform, it was like you could turn it on or off, basically. When it was turned on, it was sending all the waveforms.
So it was getting everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is the preferred route as far as controls is concerned? We have these two. Between the one you implemented for CMTS and this.
Well, I mean, so what we did for the CMTS ones for getting the data out, the protocol we designed there, it was designed to be just as little code as possible, and so, you know, most of the code is written by the protocol compiler. All you needed was all the C code was written by Josh, I guess, was to read out the registers and fill in the structure of all the registers.
It's simpler to implement.
It's very simple to implement.
The registers are easy, but the waveforms were the complex part.
Right. I mean, the waveforms were, I forget exactly how we sent them, but.
But it seems like the value that he's added with this protocol is the fact that it supports all of these different services like FTPs, plots, and.
That's something that this adds that we don't have is the fast line plot.
So how could we move either one of these forward to encompass what he's already done?
We can incorporate that. The reason we didn't do FTP there for the low-level RF things is there's waveforms that are very high frequency, or there's registers that are not very interesting to plot faster than 1 hertz or whatever.
So I think. So I think it's the sounds like a controls department in the future would support supplying this information, and you guys would do it in the most efficient way you could by and trying to provide as much capability to the people that need it.
Yeah.
So Ed has a certain, his system would be optimized in a certain way, and then we could do these individual optimizations, or we could continue to collaborate to try to find something that you guys feel is an efficient thing to support.
Yeah.
But the only command decision I was making was that we would start using hardware with FPGA ARM.
That's fine. I mean, in terms of us, I've talked with Kevin about some of the ways the PEP protocol works, and because of the application is designed for, it's just a few registers that, and if it take, and the way we generally have, or he has implemented, is you just read any register on demand whenever it's needed, but usually they're only needed at 1 hertz, or it's a fast time clock kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there were things you would have to do differently if you're trying to read 300 registers at 15 hertz.
Yeah.
Then you would maybe go to the ganging them all together method that we've done. It's more similar to what we've done for the low-level cards, where we read them all. We read the whole bunch of memory. We've got a data pool on the access front end.
And I think the things we were thinking about is moving forward a lot was to is how does all these front ends correlate, right?
Right.
We need a timing system, put some kind of timestamp on it. But again, our systems, they just start running. Because our data has to be continuous, we can't start each data packet on an external point.
Right, but you self-coordinate your synchronization. All the 8 cavities worth of or whatever it is, they self-synchronize so that when they say this is waveform number 1, they're all saying it's waveform number 1.
Does that timestamp synchronize the low-level waveforms to beam position monitors? Or
I don't know. That's the thing looking forward is we're right. Sending out these waveforms at our own pace or leisure. How does that relate to what's
so there, the BPM? If there's a global timestamp for that's passed
and
around.
I don't really understand your mechanism for the synchronization.
Is it? I don't think there is one yet.
You have one.
And
because I know once it's synced,
it's not locked down.
They all start
they can change
packets from the same pulse or the waveform from the same pulse.
Between the 8 cavities, there could be a synchronization pulse that synchronizes the acquisition.
Everybody would start at the same
time.
But then they would just free run.
Yes.
It wouldn't be at some point but where they all come back together.
To correlate it to data coming from another piece of hardware, you need a common
If you start two front ends at different times, then they're not correlated.
Yeah. Well, if there's a trigger event that resets.
That's what I mean.
Time.
The problem is we don't want things resetting in the middle of data capture. Maybe.
Well, it depends on how you set up your processes so that it doesn't cause a problem.
Yeah.
Right. You can have bad data for one cycle, bad timestamps for a cycle, but then soon as you're able to adopt the new synchronized timestamp, then you start putting out that timestamp. So you maybe you have a bad timestamp for a second.
Yeah. I think these details are
after you
look
boot up.
To, before we sit down and say, this is what we're doing.
Right. One day, John, you guys in instrumentation do this a little differently. I wonder if you could see how it's
done. So we don't use a UDP protocol for inter-process communication. We use shared memory and other POSIX-related IPC methods. So take out the PEP server in that diagram there, and the PEP driver, and we write a custom driver that just uses your typical Unix IPC to communicate with an application daemon that's running in the background. there are, now UDP is IPC. It's an inter-process communication method that is used, just as much as any of the rest. I rely on semaphores and shared memory. Kevin's approach uses UDP packets. It's a matter of, you know, what you're most comfortable with. And so this is something that, you know, I think the reason why I prefer using shared memory over UDP packets is just in a BBM application or a Toroid, we're usually dealing with large chunks of data, bigger than 4K, so I don't have to segment data and transmit it in different packets, which UDP takes care of, or PEP kind of solves that problem, but at the same time, it's, all right, here's a big chunk of shared memory, you just index into it just like it's a pointer. It's just a, you know, pick your poison type of thing.
Don't you also, though, have a PEP server, like, don't you use backdoor as well?
Yeah, so for the use case where you have a LabVIEW engineering app and you want to talk directly to your embedded system, we have backdoor running on Linux now, and that works, you know. The reason we like that approach is because we had all these backdoor-based tools already built for talking to our hardware in a VxWorks system, and if we just replace that with a Linux system, now we have the same tools. They just talk, you know, they don't care if it's a backdoor running on Linux or VxWorks, it's just kind of transparent to us.
Yeah, we originally tried to use backdoor, but at that time we were using ECOS, which is an RTOS that's now defunct. And its TCP, its stack just wasn't that great, and we couldn't maintain TCP connections for very long. So we couldn't use backdoor.
So
where is
the Linux running in your hardware? Is it in the card that's applying?
It's on the processor card. We have crates. Unlike, you know, Kevin has embedded boards, PC-104 stacks. We have crates, you know, with a x86 or Power PC. Single board computer, and then, you know, stacks of
RPC computer running Linux.
So how are we going to get all these different
data
sets to correlate, right?
So what we're doing is, like for the booster BPM, we've done a system where we synchronize with the TCLOC, was it the 8.3 or 8D, the 1 hertz event?
8F,
yeah. And then we track the, we get close with network time protocol, and then we use the 8F to synchronize on the 1 second. And we've been able to get the timestamps within a millisecond with that approach. No extra hardware required.
You should tell me about that, because I'm working on booster I'm thinking about this.
It's not the best, it's a hack. You know, I preferred solution is a hardware-based GPS time type of solution. That way you can say all of your hardware is synchronized to the same.
Could vary by 1 point.
Sure.
Yeah.
Could
the time
and that's what we see, is the nodes are off by 1 to 2 milliseconds. And so it's good enough, but it's to say that you're within a booster cycle. But
yeah. So if my data is within a millisecond of yours, that's
right. So, you know, preferred solution would be something based on GPS time that we can say, you know, with microsecond accuracy that we're synchronized.
Or, I was imagining. I'm not the brilliant person in the room for this, but, you know, for the clock system in PIP2, you know, we get a trigger and then we get clocks that are based on at the pulse resolution. And then you could actually get a trigger and then start counting the RF. You know, so you have an RF-based timestamp.
Well, the PIP2R system is generating a 9 megahertz that'll go off for.
PIP2 generates a what?
PIP2 is generating a 9 megahertz clock that'll be synchronized to the RF. So it's a 162 source. gets divided down to 9 megahertz, and that becomes the timing system clock. So everything goes off of that, and it's fit in line with the 162 that's out there.
The trigger is also aligned with that.
Not a trigger, it's a clock. So
that's the T clock equivalent, right? Or is that?
No.
No.
It doesn't have any encoded information. It's just
it's like that NML has the same thing. The 9 megahertz, I get the Mike Casera, and he generates everything from that. So something from that would have to go off and tell everybody, hey, this is when data starts.
You mean a mast oscillator?
Yeah.
Well,
so the T clock event will probably be synchronized to that clock, and that's
yeah, it'll come from that clock.
Yeah.
But I think that would have to be the source of everybody's getting
synchronization.
Synchronized. Right. And all our protocols should kind of have that in the back of their mind. Maybe something coming in telling us everybody should be ready to go.
Yeah, I see that separate from the, you know, what's up here, right? This is the data, that's the clock to networks. Yeah, so we need to talk up the timing. I think we got it started. I think we'll keep going with that in as we go along. And we'll have to get Greg Vogel come over. Come on, man. Let's go. He's you know, like I said last week, he's got some ideas. I looked at his draft. And I can see that the control system has a lot of work to do when it comes to creating this timing system. And these interfaces are, you know, just a part of that work.
So when EPIX comes down the pipe, we're going to add another protocol and another stub to this drawing? Or is
you would make an EPIX driver that speaks PEP protocol, for instance. Here.
You swap out the XSFP block for
EPIX. Replace that with EPIX.
Well, what if you replace the LabVIEW PC with EPIX?
Well, that's my information.
That's fine. You do the same thing.
I mean, is it possible?
Or you go this route where you just rip it out entirely. You have your system here, and then somewhere else there's an EPIX IOC that's then, you know, reading it out.
So how do everybody stay
in
line? Like if EPIX makes a change, it's got to go reflect on your LabVIEW client. It's got to reflect on their...
Because that's why I said... LabVIEW just talks PEP in my system. You know,
so you make an EPIX PEP interface.
It's nice to. We used to do that, and everybody look at LabVIEW and
polling.
Say, "Oh, it's not updated."
His system is polling.
Yeah, that's
so,
that's,
you know,
that's,
he refreshes on the next update.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, that's why you have the front end, the only one making the changes to the driver. Everyone else then reads the front end's information. All updated at the same time.
So you could potentially have three shim layers to deal with three separate protocols.
Yeah, I think we might have to rethink the way
Access
shim layer.
Well, you've got the Access FE, you've got an Erlang PEP driver, and you've got another driver to deal with EPIX, right?
Yeah, they're just marshaling data, though. All your business logic is
the same thing.
Still the same.
Is a layer below that.
Yeah.
As long as you design your software that way.
This is really simple.
It'll be pretty simple.
Yeah.
Is it possible to handle registers all in this format and waveforms kind of the... I don't see the solution here yet. If it's a polling scheme and it's just looking at where you put your array memory, right? There's no reason why it should be synchronized. Right? If I get a T-clock saying timing system said go, I start going off at my own pace, building up these buffers of waveforms. There's no reason why the ACNET or Erlang or EPIX will be synchronized with when those waveforms are done.
Well, I mean, I know that Axis gets T-clock. It knows you can get data on event.
But we don't, that's what I'm saying. We get the one event, we start, and it just runs. Starts compiling data, and when the buffer is full, we have a flag that goes up, and we say data is ready to be processed. And it's
so that's a different protocol or different mindset than what Kevin has.
I know that's why I'm asking this question.
So I mean, that's you know, I don't, Kevin doesn't claim this covers every situation.
I know that, but that's why I'm thinking
trying to think how we can do this with a simpler.
Well, that's where controls group could help you out with this, and then they'll figure out the best way to manage the variations.
Sending this continuum, because it's a CW RF machine, I need to look at these CW waveforms for long periods of time.
Like, that's almost like a data logging issue. You just need to be logging your data somewhere, right?
So right now we log it in lab. You need to sit there on the local machine and hit record, and it records these long things of data, and we can look at low frequency stuff. And you can't miss a block of data, because then your data is going to be totally nice if you miss it. So that's the issue that keeps haunting me.
Can we take advice from you?
I'm still going back to this, so I'm trying to understand your use case. So you have a plot of your RF cavity, and it's basically streaming data.
Yeah.
And you're just watching it like a scope through a LabVIEW application.
Not exactly. We're saving, we're tacking on
that. So you're accumulating this
huge
buffer of data.
It's more than just what you could put in a
ping pong buffer. So it's continuous.
You're just sending it to disk. You get gigabytes of data.
We're talking
30 to 60 minutes of 8 systems CW.
You're just collecting all this data.
Yes.
So you just have some type of streaming.
Yes.
Yeah. You're just
exactly.
Streaming packets.
And saving it to a binary file.
Adding it to your file.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a client's. Is that a client server? That's not a client server thing. That's just. Me sending data over there and that guy accepting it all the time.
Yeah.
Usually they have a server running in LabVIEW that their client, which is their front end, shoves data to all the time, right?
Yeah.
But again, it's sort of like the difference between using a parameter page, which is a generic ACNET thing, and having to write a custom application, right?
So the data points that you get don't have any type of timestamp on it?
No. We do timestamp on
it. No, they don't.
It could.
No, it's just.
So you keep saying if you miss a packet, all your data is bad.
It's relative to the data.
Right.
It's not an absolute.
Yeah, it's only that you know there's.
Yeah, because if
you've got one microsecond in each point.
Mm-hmm.
Oscillation in the data.
Yeah.
And you miss something, it becomes a sharp.
Sure, you got this
spike.
Chunk that's missing.
That's the problem. I haven't found the right answer yet. Philip and Ryan.
Ryan is in California trying to find an answer. They only speak epics.
The other solution was put a solid state drive right on the right at the arm.
Right.
Build up a buffer there. No, I don't have to send it anywhere. And then when it's full, you hit collect, and then go off to wherever at your own pace.
Cool. You still have to send it, though, somewhere.
Yeah, it'll send you it for an hour. It'll send off packets.
I mean, how long do you need to keep it for? Like forever?
Yeah.
No.
2 years a day?
No. You don't have to keep it that long.
Okay, only then.
Yeah, once you get it, you could erase, you could bring it back to your office and do your analysis.
To help you, a typical use case is they want to study, like, the microphonics of the cavities. And so they collect data for a day, and then they can go and mess around and look at that data and analyze it every which way they want to. And they come back and, maybe it's an important measurement. Okay, you have to at least archive the results and, be able to show that, this cavity showed it's fine. This cavity showed bad vibration signature. Do some investigation, try and get rid of the vibrations, redo the experiment. So it's, it doesn't have to be saved forever for scientific proof or anything like that.
So it's more of a diagnostic
tool.
Yeah.
It's not an operation.
Yeah, and I imagine at some point the machine's going to be operational, and then all of a sudden one day everybody's rattling around and they can't keep it in rhythm, so they're going to have to figure out where the source is.
And ideally you're able to anticipate that could happen at any time, so you're ready to have the data if the data's available.
Maybe a lower stream,
maybe some
frequencies.
Yeah, but some sort of circuit buffer it, so you can.
Uh-huh. Right. And if you flag something, hey, all of a sudden cavity 2 is shaking a lot harder.
Are we talking gigabytes?
Yes.
Hundreds of gigabytes?
Yes.
And as long as it's continuous data, you only need is one piece of information to synchronize it, you know, the absolute time when you start taking the data, right?
And well, I don't think these details have been fully flushed out. Maybe we can figure out a better way to streamline that. Or what do we really need to see?
Yeah.
Do we need to see?
Well, let's put that on the things to do list.
I mean, you can almost, I think your idea of having a local drive that as long as it had the last 2 days of data, and then you can go in there, you can even have it be an NFS, you mount it on your local PC, and you just copy it off, right?
Yeah, I wanted to put a SATA port on there. Just have the ARM write the disk. I almost got enough.
Just get two
You'd
disks,
almost get a terabyte of flash to put on a board nowadays anyway, on 5 years.
Yeah, a couple years would be able to.
Yeah, so maybe that's not a bad idea.
So for a new application, what are the pieces that can be readily, you know, transferred? For example, you use the Cyclone SoC for this, so we could probably make use of a lot of the code that you have already.
Yeah, I mean, once you have Linux, it doesn't really matter what your underlying architecture, you're picking, you know, whether it's ARM or x86 or privacy, it doesn't really matter. It's just C code that you compile it. And that's true. We have all the access running on ARM and x86 and PowerPC. The PEP server works on them all. So it doesn't really matter.
I wanted to go back and clarify some of my brief comments. We do have the beam current monitors applications that we have for PIP2. They require maybe 8 digitizer channels at a location at the most. And I was thinking we could use a board similar to Philips, or Philips board with a modification to put DC coupled A to Ds on there. And then that board would support the digitization, the interface to the timing system, FPGA processing, the ARM processor, and then the communications that are going to be more or less standard, more or less depending on how far down in the details you want to go. But we still have BPMs and beam loss monitors, and those require large channel counts in a location. So we're still looking at crate-based solutions like we've used in the past, something other than BME. John's getting some prices and some other information on microchannel or micro TCA.
Sorry.
And he's seen is it called a double wide micro TCA?
They have multiple different size options, but the ones like a, you know, 6U.
Yeah, something we're accustomed to.
Was it 8 millimeters or something?
So we're looking at the prices for those. I mean, maybe when we get these prices, they're going to be like, I don't know, way high. But maybe not.
No, they're not.
They're not.
They're reasonable.
They're reasonable. Okay, good.
I sent a request to Vodatech this morning.
Yeah. It's probably the same guy.
Yeah. They have a pretty large ecosystem.
Well, and I've met the guy. He comes to, like, the collapse, and I've seen other places, too.
Okay.
So we're going to still look at these crate-based solutions for that, as opposed to lots of Ethernet cables.
You've got a cost in mind to determine what reasonable means?
Well, what reasonable means is a little bit more than what BME setup would be, because that's what they've set so far. But I know the popularity of going to a micro TCA in like LEIA or the upper ranks of the PIP2 project, because they feel good when they look at other laboratories and the things that they're doing, which is micro TCA, and they have more confidence in it, and they would probably be willing to spend more money in that regard if, you know, that's what we see as being a good solution. So I think we could probably get the money for it. You know, Dennis is saying it's not that much more, and I think it's something that a lot of people are agreeable with. It's it's us learning. It will be a learning curve for us, but we'll look into it. We're still looking.
So, Philip, your board had FMC sites on it, right?
Yes.
And do you guys utilize that right now?
Yeah, the connection to our carrier board is through the FMC. Uh-huh. So they have FMC connectors both on the bottom and mirrored on the top. So if you have some unused pins on the bottom one, you could connect an FMC card.
So I was thinking if we had like a timing module that was FMC based, we could use it on your board, and we could, MicroTCA has tons of carrier options too, so you can get an FMC carrier, and then we could use both solutions and have a module that exists between both of them for timing or MPS or
our UCD PMCs now would have.
Right.
If this would be the,
they even have PMC carriers.
The modern timing daughter board.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that was one thing.
One possible.
They were working on. Does it have to be a connector, or they put a QSFP connector on there? And looking forward, that might be something a timing system could plug into. So everybody would have to have a.
Yeah, but that's a just. Some of the timing systems use the QSFP or SFP connection, but there is a little bit of hardware on the board, a small FPGA, and some, I think, clock, so for like for White Rabbit. There is a little bit of hardware that goes with that. In my card, it just goes straight to the FPGA, so it has to be based on the main FPGA, whatever protocol.
There would be details with the pins that you have to use, that would be part of the specification for that board that then would carry over to a micro TCA crate.
So what is QSFP?
Just a connector.
Four lanes of the
serial
bidirectional
serial
transceiver.
Okay.
So SFP is one lane.
So that,
about the same,
that was
size,
the mindset. I'm saying there's got to be a top-down decision where everybody has to have the same connection into
this
timing.
I think it's John's recommendation is it'd be a controls, almost a controls department supported daughter board like the PMC UCD now.
And everybody's got to have a.
And this would be common, and whatever the boards, the solutions that we come up with for our platform would support this board. I just made that up.
No, you got it right.
I got it right? Okay. You were listening close. You say that right? Okay, good.
But yeah, they even sell carrier boards that have like FPGAs and memory on it and an FMC site. The idea is the FMC has your ADCs or your DACs or whatever you need. And then connect that's your front panel, and then you can leverage that into your memory or your FPGA. So they're very modular in this approach. You got a module on top of a module, AMC module on top of the FMC module on top of that. You can take that out, your AMC board out, and put in a whole integrated system on module board. Lots of options.
In the micro TCA world crate, they have clock lines that are distributed to every slot.
Yeah.
That's FMC module would tie into those.
From looking at the software point of view, they have lines back there for clock and user defined
interrupts.
Well, interrupts are part of the PCIe fabric.
Interrupts are part of the PCIe.
I don't know how you do interrupts in a gigabit Ethernet system, but I assume they have some fashion of doing that.
Well, if you're in the crate, you've got signals to
play around with.
Yeah.
But if you read the overview of MicroTCA, it's like they have lines for power, they have lines for system management, and then lines for serial I/O, and then user-defined lines to clocks and other types of signals.
And then for MPS, Philip, your board already contains four fiber ports. Is it four?
Three QSFP. So it's 12 channels are there, but one would be adequate for now.
Yeah, so one dumb solution for I don't know how dumb it is, it's just first guess. Beam current measurements, they could be split at and buffered at the analog interface, and then MPS could use a second board that would be all their own, and then that would have their own digitize 8-channel digitizers or whatever else we need to specify to become universal-ish, and then it would have the fiber connections to receive data from remote measurements that way, if that could be developed. So that would be still your point-to-point. So we've worked in all three of our favorite architectures, but we find where they actually fit together. So we're still working on it. We're still looking for the prices and how-tos for the microchannel. This looks good for the ARM, the ARM nodes. And yeah, anything else for today?
So Dennis, can you give us a presentation like Kevin's on the system that you did for CMTS with Josh, just to see what advantages?
I can, sure.
Is it similar to what you do, Dennis?
No, it's different.
That is different.
Or whatever other recommendations you have for us to look at.
Yeah, I can describe that system. I don't know how useful it is.
Brian thinks it's a working system. We should use it in the next
It works. Yeah.
Nobody knows how it was implemented, so
how well I'd like to learn. Scale?
What's that?
How well does it scale?
Scale to multiple instances of it?
Yeah.
Pretty well.
We had, right now we have 4.
Yeah.
So we'll have another 16.
Yeah. Solve the data volume of the waveforms. That's the problem. If we solve that, probably.
Well, thank you, Kevin. You guys are free to chat and free to go. Yeah, the slides and audio.
Okay.
I got them both.
Hey.